Accession number 10081, reel 5.
He'd built a series of concrete blockhouses.
The Germans?
Germans. Yes. You see how clever they were? With machine gun holes in front. So we arrived at this, I went forward, trying to get a line going. But the point of the snag was this, that is, blockhouses, the entrance, of course, was... When we got there, we were facing it, you see, we were the back door, so it was the other way. So we had to suddenly rush in there and come out again. And I was so tired, I fell asleep in one, and I think a shell must have hit the top. I heard the damn thing shaking like that. Of course, it was solid concrete, you know, but the shell never went through. It just went like that, you know. We did what we could up there. We stayed several tours. Because you couldn't stay there very long. It would leave very quickly, you see. The men couldn't stick it. And, you know, the Salvation Army, they were just behind the line serving hot cocoa to our chaps. The Salvation Army uniform one. I thought that was marvellous. I thought it was a fact. They were they seemed to be the only lot that were doing, you know, good for the troops. Anyhow, this blockhouse, we came out. And then I don't know what happened. We went back again. They were getting now towards Christmas 17. And it was just in and out all the time. Because Haig didn't get through. He couldn't get through because of the mud. Then he went on too long there, didn't he? He went on to November. He had to give up in the end. Do you remember? I don't know whether you saw the Anzac film the other day, did you? The colonel said, "My men, just look what it's like to be here. That muck and filth." So Haig had to give in. He thought, oh, he wanted the Channel ports, you see. He was after Ostend. But he never got through. So things went a bit quiet. But all the time, of course, he was going towards 18. And then, of course, they were working towards...
Yes. Going back to the Third Ypres battle, what one hears so much about the terrible conditions there.
Oh,
you
yes.
know... Well, you know, how did this rate compare with the Somme, do you think? Because you went through both,
you? The Somme, you did have decent trenches. I mean, say, as soon as they held up, the soil was good. You could work the soil. But every time you put a spade in the Third Ypres, it was full of water. Now, we had to tie sandbags around. We tied sandbags around our legs to try and keep the water out. I don't think we ever had Wellingtons, and yet I believe, of course, the Germans, their boots used to come pretty high, didn't they? They you know, very far seeing that really, although they were cumbersome to walk in. But so 17 seemed to be this kind of wall of attrition, you know, keep them out of the way. Haig couldn't get through, so he had to stop. As the Australian said the other day, he had to stop. The men couldn't go any further. You couldn't do it. Your rifles were full of mud. The artillery couldn't fire because the shells were.
Was it a miserable life, you know, living in those conditions?
Yes. Well, when the bread, see, everything, the rations used to come up in sandbags in the front line, and sometimes some chap would get frightened and drop his bally sandbag, and it was the bread, loaves of bread. And of course, when it reached us, it was plastered with mud on the outside, but we're so hungry we used to cut it off. And there's another point about food. At one part in France, I think it was, they decided at Etaps, the big base, to clean the ovens out. And the whole army, well, we were anyhow, no bread for quite a time, only sea biscuits, you know, these big sea biscuits. But they were all right because the cooks used to make the bacon fat and dip them in the bacon fat. So we got a meal out of it. But there's no bread. But rations weren't too bad. The Australians sent us a lot of very nice. Used to have their quince jam, it was very nice, and their conserves. And their butter was very nice too. Margarine wasn't known in those days, I don't think.
You were saying about the lack of water at the Somme.
And the Somme, yes.
Was it a similar situation at Ypres? You know,
no,
or did you manage to get water?
No, there was water there all right, yes. Plenty of water, yes. Yeah. Had too much sometimes.
How
and
about...
And you always had a river or something there which you could go in. Yeah, no, it was just that one episode. I think we'd been too long without drink. And we were anxious to get out. And simply the water wasn't coming up to the front line.
Yes, I was wondering also, you know, about casualties in this mud. Did you see bodies sort of lying about?
Oh yes, covered with mud in that, poor chaps, couldn't move. I think Haig was a silly ass, but then he had to do what the French told him, didn't he? See.
Did you yourself, you know, your battalion, did you suffer losses?
Yes,
at Third Ypres again.
We were changing all the time. Reinforcements coming in, but from all it was not the same as when we started out in France in 1915. The whole division changed. It was I suppose it was supply and demand, and men they had to fill the ranks. I mean, so I knew men who were put into Scottish regiments with a kilt, never worn a kilt in their life. You see, that was another silly thing. Put them in trench warfare with kilts. They got plastered with mud. They stopped it later, because in the cloth split, they gave them kind of leather kilts instead of the cloth, because the pleats in the kilt used to get covered with mud, and the chaps couldn't move it. And anyhow, what was it? Yes. Now then, we're coming to the end of 17, the Third Battle of Ypres. Stuck in the mud, couldn't move. Just took day to day as it happened. Casualties, yes. Shell fire mostly. Then we move on now to early 18. Now then, we went back to our old place, Bray-sur-Somme. Back again there. Because obviously the powers that be had decided that we were on our old ground, we would know more about it, and we were our division was to be the right of the British line. So we were preparations then, as I said now, for 18. We knew when he was going to attack on March the 21st, 18. There was a conference of signalers, and behind the line, we were told when he was going to attack. We were told what to do, and everything was made there to prepare us. But before that, the French had asked us. Yes, what was it there? This is March, was to take over more of their line. Well, Haig really didn't have the men, but they sent us down to the south of the line. We had a wonderful time down there. Champagne, 5 shillings a bottle. we went there for long. It was too good to last. We took over the tracts of country, not a soul there. There was no front line. The French had left it. That was the time when I was sent forward to take over the French signal station with these telephone lines marked girls' names. So I kind of traced the line through, because I had to have a diagram for my own men coming in. And it was amazing. All they had, and we were told what to do. Sorry, gentlemen or men, there's no front line. What are we going to do? To have a series of company keeps. Company keep here. Nothing in between. A bit of wire, perhaps. Another company keep. We hadn't got the men to do it. And we were told those men in those company keeps had to stay there to the last, no matter what happened. And so it happened. Well, coming back to March, we were lucky. We'd just come out of the line 2 days before. And of course, when you come out of the line and you have a payday, you start buying little things like tins of fruit or something like that, you know, and make them easier. We'd all stocked up with this. On the morning of March 21st, foggy, thick fog, he must have known, you know, thick fog. The artillery couldn't see the rockets, you know, the red rockets for assistance. Telephone lines had gone. No one knew where they were. That was March 21st. Of course, it was stand to. Well, we were told to stand to, and it was little a place called Ham on the Somme, in front of St. Quentin, or St. Quentin as they called it, St. Quentin. And we were told to go forward and keep in reserve. I don't know who's in front of us. Or the Bedfords were, luckily, were in the company keeps. And I think they stayed almost to the last man. Well, what he did, you see, he was clever, in the fog, he put machine guns on mules' backs and came in between the keeps. So our chaps, next thing they knew, was that Jerry was behind them, you see, and they couldn't see. And one chap, we sent a small detachment forward, and I remember one chap named Jones, he'd come back. My gosh, he was scared. I said, "What's happened, Joe?" He said, "Tom," he said, "I just came out of this fog." He said, "There was a big fat German in front of me." He said, "I didn't know what to do," because he could have been court-martialed. He said, "So what I did," he said, "I slipped my arms through my kit." He grabbed me and he grabbed the kit, and I ran away as fast as I could. Yeah, I didn't tell anybody else because he couldn't be. But he was scared stiff. Anyhow, he got through. And I remember seeing the artillery were told to retire, and I remember seeing a battery coming through, and they had a wounded man between the gun and the trailer. They were trying to hold him on. He was wounded till they got back, galloping. At first I was seeing the artillery galloping backwards. So what happened then? Went forward, and a place called Rupy, R-O-U-P-Y, we were told to stay there. R-O-U-P-Y, Rupy. We were told to stay there and wait. We couldn't get division on the phone. We couldn't get brigade. Corps had gone. No one knew where they were. We just stood there. But just outside Ham, there was a very big... it wasn't Naffy Canteen in those days. It was run by the army. And it was stocked with stuff. And of course, the Germans hadn't had any food for some time. And the colonel said, "Destroy all the bottles of whiskey," but I think some of the chaps filled their bottles with it, "and fill all you can with food." I was eating chocolate for days. I was, in case we got no food, we filled all the sandbags full of chocolate, you know. Then we had to leave it for the Germans. We came back through Ham, a lovely little trench town. The Somme was at the bottom, and the engineers were just getting ready to blow up the bridge. I think we were the last through. We were walking through people's houses and through to get back. I got
the
back.
The people all gone?
Oh, they've gone. Civilians. Germans had shifted them out. Yes. Oh, yes, they've gone back. It's awful to see these houses, you know, where they just left their breakfast and that. Frightful scene, that. And we got through, got onto Ham, and just outside Ham, that's the first time I saw a plane. He came over us, hovering, trying to see who we were. We gave a signal that we were British. Then we were 9 days running back till we got to Amiens. 9 days. No one knew where we were. Used to dig in at night and fall back again. Retreat, 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 because the flanks were giving way. Men didn't know where they were. There was stragglers post. And we got back to just outside Amiens, and I think there was a river there, and I saw an officer with a revolver doing to our own men, telling them if they went back any further, he'd shoot them. Yes, the men were so... They'd been 9 days running back, very little to eat, possibly, and then he was told to hold the line till reinforcements came up. The French were supposed to relieve us, but they were late, as usual. But I saw an officer generally holding out, telling our men... we didn't know where we were. They say the British Army never retreats when it did that day. But no one seemed to... We couldn't find corps. Anyhow, the upshot was, we kept our headquarters together. We kept as much of the division as we could. We were told to... And that's the first time I saw the cavalry in action. It was the Dragoon Guards. They were acting as a screen between the French who were going to relieve us and our Serbs who were retreating. They wanted to keep it, they had the communication with their own men behind. They were cavalry on horseback. That's the only time I saw the cavalry. And we got back and they put us in trains to just outside Amiens and moved the whole division back to Saint-Valery-sur-Somme, back on the coast. If you could have seen, I don't, you know what the Russian soldiers are like with big beards? If you could have seen the, you, we looked like a lot of Russians coming up to, they hadn't shaved, you see, for days. And so we thought, oh, now boys, you're going to have a rest here. But no, 2 days, rushed up north to Bayeul, you know Bayeul, the town of Bayeul, and it was on fire. He started to attack through there. They had to stem the attack. And this little villager came through. It had been left entirely. Shops were full. Now, our chaps hadn't had a change or a bath for weeks. So they went into this lady's place and they were picking up knickers and machines. The colonel said, go on, boys. I said, have a change while they're down to get something clean on. They helped themselves to what was it, draper's shop. And then there's the brewery there too. Took over a brewery. The colonel said, well, the men can have two or three glasses, but no more. Took over the brewery. But the air was in flames. They could see it at night time. We got to this, our signals headquarters was in the doctor's house. Of course, he shouldn't have put us there because it was a wine cellar. It was a But it was silly drinking because you had to keep your wits about you. You didn't know what was happening. It wasn't worthwhile. It didn't worry me in those days, over here. I was intent on the work I was doing. And we got back to, then I say, they rushed us up to Bayeul. Then what happened after that?
Were you operating this time, your signal?
Well, we were trying to keep in communication, but it was pretty well hopeless all the time, really. We just had to follow the crowd for the time being.
Yes, and your means of communication, what would
they've gone, you see, really. We depended upon dispatch riders and that kind of thing. And they've got on, where was it, Bayeul? What happened? That was March, wasn't it? And then, this is the next episode. Troops became so scarce that we were down to what they call a composite battalion from a brigade. They called it the composite battalion. We'd lost all those men. We hadn't got the men. So that's how it ended. We went back to the coast again. And then the word came, division to be disbanded. Fancy after all that. After all, the 30th Division, no more. Sad. And then they formed what they call a cadre. There's sergeants and a few officers, and they were to stay there because there was a division. I think it was called the 74th Division. We're coming from the Middle East. We were short of troops, and they were to instruct them into French, you know, kind of fighting in France. Well, they stayed there, but they sent we poor blighters to the big base at Etaps. And it was Tirrent. Etaps, oh, the place to do what it really. I always remember divisions. 30th Division was disbanded. We all went back to Etaps to be sent wherever they wanted us to go. And I remember Sunday morning, church service, you know, you used to have church service there, you used to have huts, Roman Catholic, Church of England, Jewish. And the Australians, you know, between these two huts, were playing, you know, the Born Gamblers. And the chap, you say, oh, hymn number 54, and you hear the chap, Australian, say, money on the old dice, sir, on the old dice. You could hear them like that. They said there was two Australians there who never had a unit. They were fed by the army, especially, to keep the troops amused. And then there's a trouble. Then we missed the trouble with the bullring there, trying to make the men drill after spending months up in the front line. They brought these military police or someone down there. That was, you know, they tried to give them drill and all that. The men wouldn't have it. I think there was a film about it, wasn't there? The monocle job. It's partly true. We heard
the monocle
about
mutineer.
It.
Yes,
yes, yes. And
topless. Wasn't
yes,
it,
they wouldn't. I mean, the chaps had an awful time.
Did you hear or know anything about that at all?
No,
the mutiny?
No. You see, we were just then, and then I had another stroke of luck. You see, the time came for us to be told where to go, and they sent me to the very Lancashire division again, the 55th Red Rose division, 55th Red Rose, Lancashire division. Which were in near Bethune, and I joined one of the best Liverpool territorial battalions. They were known as the Liverpool Rifles. They were what they would call them, a crack Liverpool territorial battalion, with a wonderful Colonel McCaig, wonderful chap. I couldn't have had a better battalion. It suited us, and they took us in, joined the Singles again. Very nice crowd indeed, and. They'd had a frightful time before we got there. Well, what had happened is this, that Jerry, as we call him, knew that in front of him were the Portuguese. The Portuguese sent a unit of troops, you see. They used to sleep in the front line in their pyjamas, these Portuguese. And he attacked there, you see, with our chaps on the right. And they ran away. In their pyjamas and everything, ran away. Our chaps had to come in from there and there, and we lost our men that day, and he wanted to try to get through, you see. And our chaps didn't like the Portuguese out there, and of course, Haig issued an order of the day and said, will our troops kindly not mention our noble allies as pork and beans? Chaps used to call them pork and beans, you see, and didn't like it. They never went back to the line again. They were just scared. But they'd had a bad time, because I remember seeing the Liverpool Scottish coming out. They'd mustard gas, you see, you used to put mustard gas over. And they were, when they're blinded, they walk in a long line with one man's hands on the shoulders, one man leading the front. I saw them coming out. They'd had a frightful time. Anyhow, it was a very nice...
Is that what they were doing? You know, just a long...
Yes,
line
but
the
first man could see, but the others had been blinded with this mustard gas. And these mustard gas shells, you know, you couldn't hear them. They used to go plop. First time we heard them, we used to be in laughing. One said, "Here, for God's sake, put your gas mask on quickly." It was this gas coming over. I stayed with that battalion, and. Of course, they started to draw. I was at Australia for him at Villa's, you know, they drove him back. So we were told we'll follow him up. We had in front of us, we had a battery of field guns, I think a squad of cavalry and cars. They were kind of leading. And the order was to march forward. The whole army was on the move then forward, you see. He knew he was beaten. He knew he was beaten. Old Iron Mart forward. Bring the regimental bands up to play the music for the men. And we started off. You know, we came to one village there where the Germans had suddenly gone quickly, and there was all musical instruments. They must have had a band playing there or something. And we got to Tournai. That's a lovely little town. It's a cathedral town, isn't it? And... rows and rows of houses, but not a soul in them. It's a frightful scene. He'd sent them all back. So
is that a weird scene, you know, to
yes,
see houses vacated?
Yes, see, you go in a house, breakfast, things laid, bed, our choice. Of course, they slept in the beds, the first chance they'd had a decent sleep at a time. You couldn't blame them, could you? They'd never had a decent bed to sleep in. And we got to Tournai there. And what happened? Something happened there.
Were there any booby traps? Did you come across
booby
traps?
Oh, yes. We warned of booby traps. He had them everywhere.
What sort of things did he do?
Trigger happy, you know. Perhaps you'd see go into a dugout without unsuspecting. You find there's a live bomb down there, something like that. And he used to put them in the. Sergeant Major said one day to us, "Let's have a sing song tonight, because things were getting a bit easier than we knew on the move. Will you bring the piano out of number four? And we'll have a sing song." Well, for heaven's sake, he said, before you bring that piano out, examine. He used to put them in his little, bomb things inside there. Oh, he was up to all that kind of tricks. Places where the men were likely to go, you know. And you had to be very, very careful what you're doing. Oh, and of course you had these pressure mines underneath, you know.
What were they?
Well, I think he used to put little mines down in the ground. He used to tread on them. But I'm not quite sure whether they came out then or later on. I wouldn't be sure on that point. But I knew we had to be very careful, because the Germans were very clever, that kind of thing. Wherever he could do a trick, he'd do it, you see. Anyhow, we got to Tournai, and then the army said, well, we didn't know whether we were going to the Rhine, or the order came through, take Wellington's road to Brussels. And we marched to Brussels. I've never seen a sight like it in my life, with all the bands playing. The whole British army were on the move. And as it went through Tournai, Hal, which was near Brussels, the people came out and they had little Belgian flags. And everybody, the men, stuck at the top of their rifles, and there was a sea of flags marching through the town. The people were there. We got to Brussels, and I had a wonderful couple of months at Brussels. I loved Brussels. I knew everything. Used to go out there, because everything was free. Used to go on the cars and everything free. And I got home early in 19.
Yes, where were you when the armistice was declared? Whereabouts?
Ah, that's a point. Now, you see, we didn't know anything about it. We were forward. The whole battalion was on the move. We didn't even know if there was going to be an armistice. And suddenly, at about 5 to 11, the battalion was halted, and the colonel called the buglers. Now, he said, 11 o'clock, please sound ceasefire. First time I've ever heard it. And the buglers sounded the ceasefire. But, you know, we weren't excited. They just took it as a matter of course. We were told to... Billeting officers went forward to the next village, and they did what they could to help the men. They formed... one or two of the officers were headmasters, or some of the men were masters too. And we had attended school in the village just till time of demobilisation. It was a wonderful scene, but the Belgians took to us. And those Brussels, it's a fascinating city. And there was a family we used to go to. This woman used to make wonderful waffle cakes. Oh, she was marvellous. And the billet I had, we used to give her our rations and what she could do with it. Bully beef, wasn't it? Mayonnaise sauce, I've never seen like it really, mayonnaise. Because we hadn't been used to that for some time. But we could go anywhere in Brussels, and the women, they had no soap, you see, there's no soap. Weren't they glad to get a bar of soap? And also, you know, the army blankets. What the ladies did there, made a beautiful coat out of an army blanket, cut it down, I don't know how they did it, buy some buttons. You can see them walking in Brussels with these army blankets. The fellas made pounds out of it. They were selling everything they could. Oh, gosh. It was an experience. There's a lot of little things come to mind, you know, but...